From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
On Tuesday, an extraordinary federal budget will be brought down for these extraordinary times. It will have a massive deficit and high levels of spending to sustain the economy as it struggles out of the pandemic and towards recovery. Today, to talk about what the budget is likely to do and what it should do, we have with us Chris Richardson from Deloitte Access Economics, which this week produced its pre-budget analysis. Chris Richardson, what do you expect to be the three or four headline takeouts on Tuesday night?
You will see, I would say, continuing support for Australian families and Australian businesses, lots of dollars, but gradually starting to go on the front foot. Not so much continuing defence of old jobs, but starting to think about new jobs and perhaps ways that the government can support that in the near term.
When you talk about new jobs, what are you referring to here and indeed old jobs?
JobKeeper's been a magnificent success, the right policy at the right moment. But what it's designed to do, the biggest dollars in play have been keeping people in the jobs they were in. And that's worked very well, but the longer this goes on, increasingly we will find that the businesses that have been reliant on JobKeeper for many, many months may not be there on the other side of this crisis. And so to some extent, supporting old jobs with our taxpayer dollars becomes less valuable over time. It may make sense for the government to start to look for new jobs, perhaps providing same sort of idea as JobKeeper, a wage subsidy, but looking to subsidise increases in payrolls from businesses over and above their average of the last 6 months. Again, temporary and targeted, perhaps 6 months, and paying a percentage of the extra wage bill.
Now, we expect some of the legislated tax cuts to be brought forward, and there's been a controversy over this. Is this the right course, do you think?
Look, three questions about the tax cuts. Are they fair? Are they too big? And are they good stimulus? And all three questions you need to think about. Australia has spent a lot of time thinking about whether these tax cuts are fair. Our assessment, though, and it essentially matches Treasury's assessment, is different from, I would say, the broad opinion. You know, the broad opinion sees these tax cuts as unfair. Our analysis, Treasury's analysis, would point out that they don't change the relative shares of personal tax getting paid by low-income earners, middle-income earners, high-income earners. In fact, top 1%, top 5% of taxpayers will be, if anything, paying slightly more than was the case before the tax cuts came in. So see them as fair. And that's important because many people see them as unfair, and I think that's getting in the way of the other important bits of the discussion.
And they are the later tranches of a wider package, aren't they? The earlier ones were already delivered.
Yes, we've seen phase one of a three-phase package. We've always said we thought they were too big, that they promised too much too soon. You would probably say at this point that that's proved to be true. Equally, though, that's now a debate that's been had, that they are legislated. The question is, should you bring them forward, and is that good stimulus? The key to effective stimulus to the government helping to fight to get jobs back is that the money is spent. You know, it's no use the government doing something, putting an extra dollar into play, but that money not being spent. So that's why economists like things like infrastructure, for example. And it is the key caution on these tax cuts. They may not be spent because high-income earners pay such a large proportion of personal tax. Top 1% pay about 18 cents in the dollar. Top 5% pay about one-third of all personal tax. They may save it. So if the bring forward of personal tax cuts was happening instead of a bunch of other things, that would worry me. It would say poor stimulus spending. If it's being done on top of, if it's as well as, and that's the impression I have so far, then more than happy to see it as part of the fight to get our jobs back.
A survey of economists, which was done by the Economic Society of Australia in The Conversation, has found that they think the budget should give priority to spending on social housing and boosting job seeker. Do you think those are the best priorities? Are you surprised by their choice?
They're great priorities. They're not surprising priorities. They absolutely make sense. They make more sense, for example, than the tax cuts do. To be clear, though, to me, the conversation should not be this or that. We are at a moment where it needs to be this and that. You look at those two, and we've been long-standing advocates of raising the unemployment benefit, job seeker on a permanent basis. COVID has increased the case, has improved the case for doing that, partly now because there are many more unemployed, so the nation's long-standing fairness file there is now applying to many more people, and partly because the least noticed thing about this crisis is how geographically specific it is. The job losses in Australia have been far and away the biggest where unemployment rates, suburb by suburb, town by town, out in the bush, were already the highest. If you like, the areas that were struggling are now struggling a lot more. The areas that weren't struggling haven't been that hard hit. And one real advantage of boosting unemployment benefits, it's probably the single most targeted regional spend you can do in Australia at a time when that is needed most. Social housing, again, think of what this virus has done all around the world. It's found the weakest link in every nation. You know, it's travelled through the political system, the political divide in the US. It's travelled through the migrant workers, construction workers in Singapore. In Australia, it's showed up, or could have shown up, through our very low unemployment benefit. I'm very proud that one of the first things we did as a nation was to double it, even if so far that's a temporary thing. And social housing, you saw those towers locked down as the virus got away on us in Melbourne. And again, both social housing and unemployment benefits, that's money that would be spent. It makes it good stimulus.
Do you think the government's doing the right thing by phasing back JobKeeper at this point? Are you worried about a tsunami of company collapses despite last week's announcement by the government to help smaller businesses deal with insolvency?
We'd say it's a little too early to be phasing JobKeeper back. And to be clear, JobKeeper should be phased back. It will, over time, become a less effective defence against the economic impacts of this virus. We need to go from the back foot defending old jobs to the front foot and trying to get new jobs. It's just happening a little bit early. We know there is a stunning amount of support, not just JobKeeper, JobSeeker and a bunch of federal government things. There's some state government things. There are the rent and mortgage deferrals and the like. Pretty much all of those, you know, the enormous list of support for families and for businesses is currently scheduled to run out between now and the end of March 2021. And that looms as a big cash crunch. You could see a range of small businesses finally collapsing as the temporary support goes away. You know, all those sorts of challenges. And you mentioned, by the way, those insolvency changes. Very happy to see them. Arguably more can be done, whether you're looking at insolvency or indeed personal bankruptcy. Lots of what Australia does, you know, those laws have been focused on punishing and shaming people. Right now, all sorts of small businesses and small business people are about to head into bankruptcy because they've been hit by lightning.
Do you think some special arrangement should be made in the budget for the Victorian situation?
There is a case for that. To be fair, you look at JobKeeper, JobSeeker, they are geared not to states, as it were, to Victoria, but to saying, is there a problem? Is the revenue of business still down a lot? Have you lost your job?
But they'd kick in more for Victorian businesses and individuals, of course, but over and above those.
Yeah, and Treasury's made the point that we're just about to be 60% of total number of people Australia-wide on JobKeeper being in Victoria. Is there a case over and above? Yes. We know oldest problem in recessions is that unemployment goes up fast and down slow. That's a problem for all of Australia. It will be a particular problem in Victoria, which faces a bigger hangover than any other part of Australia.
No one these days seems to be talking about company tax cuts, yet it was only a few years ago when then Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull declared that they were the key to jobs and growth. Were they ever that important, and why are they less important than they were in those days?
I have to admit to be one of the remaining fans of company tax cuts. The press they had was not very good. The economics of company tax cuts are good, and I think they would be beneficial for jobs and growth. And right now, of course, jobs and growth are more important rather than less important. But the politics of them are completely toxic. They are effectively off the agenda. What does appear to be on the agenda is the poor man's version of tax cuts. A business investment allowance. Now, the idea there is that there's greater tax incentives for businesses putting new money in, new investments for the sorts of things that may not otherwise happen right now, refurbishing a shopping mall, building a new office block, the airline starting to buy airplanes again. Doing a whole bunch of maintenance and buying their machinery and equipment around that. The advantage, what a business investment allowance is trying to do, is to get many of the jobs and growth benefits of company tax cuts without being as costly as company tax cuts. And they have been, over time, admittedly on a smaller scale, a more bipartisan area of the policy debate.
Another thing that's very little talked about is the collapse of migration in the wake of the closing of the borders. We've gone from very high levels of migration fueling economic growth to no migration. What do you think will be the implications of that in a broad sense? And when would you anticipate that we would get back to at least a reasonable level of migration, and do you think it'll settle permanently at less than we had?
And so if you think of the long success of Australia at avoiding recession, almost three decades, and to be clear, we have been a very successful economy, but that record run was very much flattered by the fact that we attract a lot of migrants from around the world. Australia had people power powering our economic growth in a way that Europe and the US and Japan, many areas we would compare ourselves against, they didn't have that. Now we have what they have, very little population growth. And that is a challenge. It's a challenge not merely because it says overall growth in Australia will be slower to bounce back, but also because the shape of our economy has been geared to that people power, the size of our university sector and the way we've arranged to have it pay for itself. The construction sector in Australia, which went into this crisis employing one in every 11 Australians. It's a remarkable thing, but a lot of that's driven by our population growth. When we get that back, when we get migration back, will be a function of the health side of this crisis, when politicians here and there are comfortable enough to be opening borders and families here and there are comfortable enough to be travelling and indeed moving permanently. Now, we see borders opening gradually through calendar 2021, maybe a little ahead of that for New Zealand. You wouldn't at best get migration flows back to what they used to be until calendar 2022. And there is a question whether we'll have less migration ongoing. But one thing I'd note is that although I'm very much a fan of focusing on getting jobs back into Australia at the moment, there are a bunch of people who say, well, you know, if that's the aim, shouldn't we keep the borders closed to migrants? Won't it be easier to get unemployment down if we keep migrants out? And that's a very appealing barbecue conversation, if you like. It's not good economics. You know, basically, if a migrant arrives and gets a job, then they earn an income, spend an income, and create the next job. The pace of migration has never driven long-term unemployment levels in Australia. Hasn't for centuries, and hasn't anywhere in the world, basically. And I don't see that as a problem.
Now, the government in July presented an economic statement when it was forecasting a huge deficit of $184.5 billion for 2021. What's happened since to change the economic picture? Has it changed significantly? And what's your best guess of the likely deficit or deficit range that we'll see for this financial year in the budget?
Given that Melbourne went into stage four lockdowns a couple of weeks after the government last updated the economic and budget outlook just over a couple of months ago, and of course regional Victoria went into stage three at the same time, you could be certainly forgiven for thinking that things will be a bunch worse. Having said that, Treasury, you know, its last update came down July 23rd, the worst possible week in which to update the Australian public on the outlook, because Melbourne was going bad at that stage. So Treasury, or perhaps it was the government, put some wriggle room in there, you know, forecasts around jobs and some other things. One notable forecast that it got wrong was it thought that the iron ore price, something very important to Australia, would see a face plant, would see an immediate nosedive, basically halving you know, before the end of 2020. That the fact that iron ore's gone up rather than down, the fact that Treasury left a bit of wriggle room, basically the size of the economy is not going to be enormously different when we get to the budget. The budget deficit for this financial year probably going to be a bit worse. So we say just under $200 billion are the key difference. So government's made lots of announcements in the last couple of months, including an extra $15.5 billion because it made it easier to get JobSeeker as a result of what was happening down in Melbourne. And that's the key reason why we now see something closer to $200 billion. That's, however, closer to $200 billion before the decisions you'll see announced on budget night. Tax bring forwards, investment allowances, extra money for pensioners, possibility of forward-looking wage subsidies around adding new jobs. You know, all these sorts of things will be adding to the deficit. I'm not going to be surprised if we see $230 billion announced in a week.
What do you see as the big danger points for the Australian economy in the months ahead?
Virus. All around the world, the key leading indicator for any economy is how it's going against the virus. If the nation sees virus numbers get away on it, then you see a combination of mandatory restrictions of some kind, but you also see families and businesses getting more scared around what happens next. And so Australia, you know, we can get lost in the detail of what's happened and should we have done this, should we have done that. Even with The Victorian story of the last couple of months. Australia's performance against the virus has been world-class. The hit to our economy has been much smaller than you've seen in much of the world. If we can keep virus numbers down, and that story is currently great, then Australia's economy, I suspect, will outperform on a number of fronts. But keep watching the virus. That will tell you what's going to happen to the economy.
Josh Frydenberg has said that the government will emphasise recovery over debt and deficit until unemployment is comfortably under 6%. Is that a reasonable benchmark for recovery?
I thought that announcement from the government, that benchmark, was a very good one. I think Renee Zellweger had it best when she said to Tom Cruise, "You had me at hello." That benchmark, the idea that we need to fight for jobs as the key focus of national policy, is the right one. Right now, we are still in a fight for our lives, and we're doing really well. But the fight for our lives has been a fight where the key beneficiaries were always going to be older Australians. The fight to get our jobs back, the key beneficiaries are going to be younger Australians. Both fights are desperately necessary. And the government officially was effectively saying that public enemy number one, the focus of policy, is going to be getting unemployment down. And I would absolutely agree. That needs to be the focus. We can get worried about the things that we used to be worried about when things get back to normal. But they won't get back to normal until, as the government says, we have an unemployment rate comfortably under 6%.
Do you think that debt and deficit matter in the medium term, or have they been overemphasised in political rhetoric in recent years? But if they do matter, when do they need to be addressed?
Deficits matter, and down the track, as the government says, after unemployment is comfortably under 6%, we should be thinking about deficits again. Debt, let me put it this way. Our analysis would suggest that as a result of the fight against this virus, the debt owed by the Australian government almost 3 years from now, the middle of 2023, will be $401 billion higher than the government had been projecting ahead of the virus hitting. And we all know that. And you know, in budget night and those headlines will all be about the increase in debt, but they should not be. What actually matters in economics is a combination of debt, sure, and it's gone up a lot, but also interest rates. It's the combination of those two that says what you need to pay ongoing. Debt has leapt. Interest rates have crashed. And the crash in interest rates applies not just to the new debt, but also gradually to the old debt. The old debt will get rolled over. Believe it or not, we forecast that the amount of interest that the Australian government will be paying in a few years' time will be $2.5 billion less than we were paying in 2018-19. Don't underestimate the fall in interest rates. Now, $2.5 billion less is not quite as good as the government had hoped. It had hoped to do $4 billion less. That difference between the two, $1.5 billion a year, sure. We will have to pay a higher interest bill as a result of our fight against this virus. $1.5 billion a year, if you translate that into a weekly cost for the average Australian taxpayer, $2.66 a week, which is a Bunnings sausage sandwich a week. Because the debt is so brilliantly newsworthy, because we're not concentrating on interest rates at the same time, Australians, I think, are far too worried about the ongoing costs of this. They are much, much cheaper than realised. It's, because of interest rates, this defence of our lives and livelihoods has been cheap as chips. And after we reach that trigger point that the government has correctly pointed to, getting unemployment comfortably back under 6%, we should worry about the deficit again. We should be focused on that. We shouldn't try to repay the debt, like any other wartime debt, and this has been a type of war. We need to let it sit in the rearview vision mirror and get focused on growing the economy instead.
In terms of growing the economy, there's been a lot of talk about reviving manufacturing in Australia. But is this realistic? And if you think it is, what would such a revival look like?
So all around the world, this crisis has showed that nations weren't ready. They hadn't taken out enough insurance. I don't mean commercial insurance. We just weren't quite ready enough for a crisis like this. Now, you saw that in Australia as we struggled around getting health-related supplies. And I think there is a great case for many of those health related supplies to be manufactured here in Australia. I would even happily see those relevant factories government owned so that in the next crisis, because there will be a next crisis, if it's a health crisis, we can go from 0 to 100 in terms of what we're doing around some of this stuff. There may also be a case, you're seeing what the government's doing, for example, in rebuilding a strategic oil reserve and the like. There may be a case for doing more around local defence manufacturing than I would have said ahead of this crisis. So I think specifics, maybe in health, maybe in defence-related stuff. It's not clear to me that manufacturing in general needs heaps of government support at the end of this crisis. There are specific areas where we are at risk, but more broadly, the world does a bunch of stuff, manufactures a bunch of stuff better than we do, and we should be happy to take advantage of that and do the many, many things that we do well and sell that to the world.
You've always emphasised over the years the centrality of China for the Australian economy. How do you see the Chinese economy performing over the short and medium term? And how do you see the future of the economic relationship?
The politics is tricky and it's well debated, so I'll leave that side of it to the politicians. The economics, China is coming out of this relatively stronger. It's an economy which shook off the virus, so far anyway, earlier than most, whereas you're seeing most of the rich nations around the world struggle in a variety of ways. So for a long time, for decades, we have seen China growing as a share of the world economy. That's just moved massively faster. It's also, by the by, for all the stuff that is happening around the politics, the trade around barley, the threats around beef and wine and whatever else, it is still the case that Australian exports to China have almost doubled since early 2017. So across a period in which the politics have become trickier, the dollars have actually done really quite well. Our imports have grown almost 30% across the same period. And partly that's because if you focus on the economics, it remains true that Australia has what China needs and vice versa. We are lovely complements for each other. Again, the politics is tricky, but the economics remains compelling and, if anything, is becoming more compelling. So let's hope the politics, one way or another, are solved.
Finally, a crystal ball question. How many years until the Australian economy gets back to where it was before in terms of unemployment, growth and so on? Or do you think it'll never be quite the same again?
Look, some things will never quite be the same again. We won't, for example, catch up in migration terms and the like. The future Australian population will always be smaller than we'd expected ahead of this crisis. Things like unemployment, though, we will be back to where we were. We were just above 5% unemployment as this crisis hit. We may be anything up to 5 years still away from that point. Again, unemployment goes up fast and down slow. But it is entirely doable. For all the things we've done wrong through this crisis, and we've done plenty, don't forget that Australia, compared to other nations, has been a success story, has continued to do the right thing. I'm kind of hopeful that on budget night that will continue. despite all the challenges, it's been a pretty proud year to be an Australian. And so far, we've handled this crisis much better than many other nations.
Chris Richardson, thank you very much for talking with the Conversations Politics podcast. We'll be interested in your analysis after the budget. And that's all from us today. Thank you to my producer, Tom Glassie. We'll be back with another interview post-budget. For now, goodbye.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.